Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Oh, here we go. See, I told you it was going to surprise us.
Uh-huh.
Never fails.
Does what he wants.
Hey, everybody, it's Guy Rizdahl. I'm here with Molly Wood. Today is Tuesday. That makes this the big show day, the deep dive day, the single topic where we all get smart with all y'all's help.
Yes. And today that topic is dark money in the 2020 election, which is nothing new exactly, but kind of like it's vaguely ominous sounding name mm-hmm. is a little not very well understood. You may have heard the term pop up again. Full disclosure, the big reason we're doing this episode is because the term popped up during the confirmation hearing of Supreme Court Justice nominee Amy Coney Barrett. Senator Sheldon Whitehouse did this kind of amazing presentation featuring a series of placards talking about dark money and influence. You know, that led to our usual very well-considered story selection process in which somebody says in Slack, we should totally do an episode on that. And then we do.
Yeah. The best part about that White House thing was for half an hour, I kept waiting for the question that he was going to ask her. But there was, of course, no question.
It was
form of a lecture. Right. Exactly. Anyway, so White House went through the whole relationship of dark money to specifically Judge Barrett's nomination and how it got there. He, of course, being a Democrat, focused on dark money from the GOP. But look, everybody's got money. Everybody's spending it, Democrats and Republicans alike. So we are going to spend a little time today with Sheila Krumholz. She's the executive director of the Center for Responsive Politics, which tracks money and a bunch of other stuff in American politics. Sheila, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. Great to be with you.
Could we do some nomenclature first? Dark money. What does that mean?
Mm-hmm. Dark money refers to money whose source we can't see. So we're in the dark about where the money is coming from, who's giving the money, what it's buying, and what motivations are driving those messages.
So how is dark money legal? For those who did not...
Bollywood, right to the chase.
Aren't we supposed to know how money gets spent on influencing our politicians and...
Indeed supposed to know. In fact, the court decision that has paved the way for dark money, Citizens United, a famous Supreme Court decision from a decade ago, was based on the notion that we would be able to see where the money was coming from, that we had adequate disclosure, and so we could judge for ourselves whether the money was having undue influence. Over politics and policy. Unfortunately, the Supreme Court got it wrong. They said by an 8-1 margin that they affirmed the need for disclosure, but they did not ensure it, nor has Congress. And so we're left in this netherworld of supposedly having transparency in politics, but having this gaping, hole through which millions and millions of dollars pour every cycle from unknown sources. And it's coming mostly from nonprofits. These are social welfare organizations, mm-hmm. ostensibly. Not your average Boys and Girls Clubs, unfortunately. These are groups that are often highly political and have a number of attributes that really are concerning and lead us to believe that they're really just political committees hiding as tax-exempt organizations.
Could you give an example of how it works? I'm a donor, whether I'm rich or not, doesn't really matter, but I give to one of these social welfare groups, and then what happens?
Well, if you give to a social welfare organization, or it could be a different type of nonprofit, but one that's highly political, they may spend the money without reporting where they got the money. And if it is spent on behalf of a federally identifiable candidate, it needs to be reported to the FEC, the spending, as long as it's within the windows right before primary mm-hmm. or general. But we would not have any way of knowing where it came from. And for that matter, one of the, I think, most striking, most worrying aspects of this is since we don't know where it's coming from, we really can't be sure it's even legal, it's even domestic. Perhaps it's coming from a foreign source, a foreign government, a foreign corporation. Who knows? It's an honor system at this point.
So basically, to super break it down for those who were not sort of following this over the last 10 years, the Citizens United ruling essentially said that for purposes of political donation, businesses, and it sounds like you're saying nonprofit organizations, are the same as people. And then that led to this kind of new funnel?
Yes. Businesses were deemed corporations are people per the Supreme Court. There was grave concern as part of this debate on Citizens United that corporations would now be allowed to raise and spend unlimited sums from their vast corporate treasuries to reshape the political landscape. And it's not happening in the sense that the corporations are not now spending directly. Mm-hmm. Target is not, you know, taking out ads for or against a presidential candidate. Home Depot is not spending directly. There are some corporations that are giving directly to these highly political super PACs and nonprofits. We don't know about the non-disclosing groups. We can only see what we see in reports to the FEC. So that they aren't spending directly, and largely I think that's because many of them fear the retribution of their customers. They don't want boycotts based on their political involvement. So that hasn't materialized as many people feared. But again, since we don't know where the money's coming from to these dark money organizations, these non-disclosing nonprofits, it may be that the money is corporate. It may be, it's probably likely that it's coming from the same individuals that we've been seeing give tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars over time to the parties, to these outside groups. You know, they're practically household names at this point. Sheldon Adelson and the Koch brothers on the right, George Soros, Tom Steyer on the left. Yeah. So it may be corporate, but I think regardless, the concern here is we are not allowed to know. And if we are not allowed to know where the money is coming from, then we can't judge for ourselves the credibility of the message, the credibility of the messenger. It depends so much on who's behind the message. Yeah. What motivations are driving them? We just don't know.
We've been around the horn on campaign finance in this country a gazillion times. Most recently, McCain-Feingold, and then Mitch McConnell sued to overturn parts of that, and then Citizens United. Do you anticipate that there will be another whack at this apple, given, as you say, how the Supreme Court miscalculated in Citizens United?
I think so. I think... The battle is far from over. It's mired in partisan politics. But what American left, right, or center, who would want to think that we're the suckers, you know, patsies in this game of billionaires? We want to know who the players are that are shaping politics, and it matters. It matters how much they're spending and what they're getting in return. And if we don't know who's behind it, we can't ask these questions. We need to be able to consider the source of the money to understand what's going on, and to be able to represent our own best interests in politics, as we must.
And we should be clear here that it both parties are taking this money. Right.
Absolutely.
And then it sounds like, it sounds like progressives have gotten a lot better, have maybe even lapped the GOP when it comes to soliciting and taking dark money.
That's true. The conservative outside groups and dark money organizations had been far outspending liberal groups for many years following Citizens United, but it is now reversed, and liberal organizations are spending more. All told, dark money is down this cycle, but what's changed is that partially disclosing organizations have ramped up. So now if you're an organization, you're fundraising, you can go to a donor and give them a menu of options. If you don't mind public and press scrutiny, you can give to our publicly disclosing super PAC. If that's inconvenient for you or would undermine the messaging we're trying to put out, then please give to our non-disclosing nonprofit. And then that nonprofit will transfer it to the super PAC, which discloses, but it's not going to disclose the original source of the money. So we're in the same we're in the same situation whereby we have billions of dollars at this point, $2 billion in outside spending, and 46% of it is coming from groups that do not fully disclose their donors.
Why are you optimistic that this fight is not yet done? I mean, we don't have a champion, right? John McCain is no longer around, obviously. Russ Feingold is not in office. Mitch McConnell is, for the nonce anyway, stronger than ever. There does not seem to be a push to regulate money in politics. And oh, by the way, money is speech. The Supreme Court said so. How can you, I mean, I guess it's your job to be optimistic about this, but why?
I am optimistic because I believe in common sense prevailing eventually. Once we kind of get back to the business of negotiating, of compromise, of politicking in a way that is productive and not simply partisan, which serves, I think, fewer and fewer people. So two things. First of all, again, I don't think liberals, I don't think conservatives ultimately want the best politics money can buy. I think they want to know and trust the integrity of the system. And that means we have to defend the pillar of transparency. It's so essential to our democracy. Second, small donors have been increasing and now account for 22% of all committees fundraising, giving nearly $2 billion already this cycle. And that's up from 14% in 2016. So each cycle, small donors are more small donors are participating. Their contributions are adding up to more, and proportionally they're growing. And I think that is a good sign for democracy. You know, giving money is a perfectly legitimate way to participate in our democracy. Our system depends on private contributions. But who wouldn't rather have a million, you know, $5 donors than one $5 million donor? It simply stands to reason that we'll have a healthier, more representative democracy if more people participate and if more of the funding comes from a larger pool rather than a very concentrated pool of affluent people.
Well, and I wonder if, you know, we've talked on this show before in the context of wealth inequality about how that starts to show up in politics when you suddenly see politicians who don't seem to represent your interests in, you know, whether you are actually a constituent or writ large, where you see, you know, 70, 75% of Americans having one opinion on a topic, but somehow the vote's never going that way. Like, does it depend on people understanding how dark money works and seeing over and over and over that, for example, a coronavirus relief bill would be a politically incredibly popular thing to do, and yet it doesn't happen?
Yeah, it's a great question.
You know, like, does that start to make these forces more obvious to people in a way that would cause them to agitate for change?
I think so. I hope so. I hope they agitate in a way that is smart and informed and productive. We need people to be both informed and then to get engaged. And to not just hold their representatives, their political public officials' feet to the fire, but to engage in a relationship with them. Because short of that, if we don't build a relationship with our employees in Washington, effectively, there are people hired to take our place to develop those relationships for the benefit of their clients. Lobbyists are paid a lot of money. They know a lot. They have a great deal of expertise to provide to representatives, senators, the government. But they're going to do it in a narrow way that benefits the person paying the bill. And so we need to be at the table, too. We need to, you know, unfortunately, I don't think there's an easy way out of doing the work of democracy, of being a part of the system, being informed, and making ourselves heard. So hopefully, you know, small donor platforms like Act Blue on the left and Win Red on the right, maybe those will be kind of the gateway drug to get people involved. Hopefully they won't just be fundraising, you know, giving money because they're so outraged, but also then becoming invested in the candidates, but in the system, in the process. So that, you know, I think that's what it's going to take. It's not going to be there's no shortcut, yeah. I think, to this.
Yeah. Sheila Krumholz at the Center for Responsive Politics in Washington. Sheila, thanks a lot. I really appreciate your time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you. Fascinating. Yeah, for some, a little numerical context, by the way, Kimberly Adams did a story with Sheila back in January around the 10-year anniversary of Citizens United. And from that story found that non-party outside groups have spent $4.5 billion in campaigns, including almost $1 billion from groups that don't have to disclose their donors. Like, it's a lot, is what I'm saying. It's a lot of money.
Write to us, would you, about money in politics, about what you hear on the pod. Anything. Actually, make me smart at marketplace.org. Voice memos are better just because more of you talking, less of us talking is always a win. We'll be right back. We'll be right back.
Get one of the most successful broadcasts in television history on your schedule with the 60 Minutes podcast. Hard-hitting investigative reports, news, and culture maker interviews, and in-depth profiles are waiting for you in every episode. Listen to 60 Minutes every Sunday wherever you get your podcasts.
It is time for the news fix. I'm excited because Kai didn't even bother with a link. He's just going single word topic.
Google. but I'm somehow fascinated by yours, the URL of which reads, at least 7 charged in 1 million flying squirrel trafficking scheme. So I don't even know what that is.
Yeah. I have questions. It tells you just how banana pants the news is across the board. That basically, I was like, I just want to know about this squirrel trafficking story. The background here is that I switched my browser today. This is actually unrelated to the antitrust case, but I switched from Chrome to Microsoft Edge. And yeah, because Chrome wouldn't load. It still has this like memory leak issue.
Huh.
And it was just annoying. And I was like, you know what? I don't have time for this. I'm going to try out Microsoft Edge. And then it turns out Microsoft Edge has, like, the homepage is sort of MSN news stories that are all over the place. It's like a different universe. Like, forget about Google News and all the bummer stuff. The, like, Edge homepage is like, 7 people have been charged in a $1 million scheme in Florida to traffic flying squirrels to South Korea as pets. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to look here
today. We should just do that. The hell with Google. We should just talk about flying squirrels. Oh,
I've just
man.
Decided to live here in Microsoft Edge land today because it's fun and
maybe
new.
I'll do that. Maybe I'll do
and
that.
Not like the other thing.
Okay. Yeah. I mean,
but we can talk about your thing.
We don't
now.
Really have to because if you listen to Marketplace this afternoon or if you listen to Tech tomorrow morning, there's going to be plenty of this stuff. I just, I guess my question to you is what took them so long to say, oh my God, Google's too big and powerful?
Okay, so what's actually really interesting that I'm going to tell you on your show in just a couple of hours is that it really probably should have taken a little longer.
Well, save the good stuff. I don't want to act surprised. I want to be surprised.
All right. Okay. I'll save it.
All right.
Yep. But don't worry, everyone. There will be lots and lots. Yeah. I feel really bad, actually, because some people are going to just listen to this and be like, give me the dirt.
So they can listen to Tech tomorrow or Marketplace this afternoon. Come on. Be multi-sourced in your news. Get all the Marketplace products.
Yes.
The hell with everything else. Just get
for
all
now,
of us.
For now, friends.
Yes, just today.
Turns out flying squirrels are a hot commodity as pets in South Korea. Who knew?
What's that? Is that the mailbag sting I hear? I think that is the mailbag sting I hear. Oh, except you know what's funny? I think Drew had either fallen asleep or walked out. I don't know what he did.
Oh, he
hello,
did not
Molly and Kai.
It's Brianna from Phoenix.
I am from Brooklyn, New York.
Longtime listener, first time voicemailer.
I want to discuss a slightly different, but maybe related thing.
he was head down on the control panel in there. I don't even know.
You don't think he's paying attention, but he always is.
always is. Okay, so the first one is in response to all the mask wearing that you saw at the airport during your trip not too long ago to see your folks. Here you go.
Hi, Kai and Molly. This is Tom Inglis calling from Katy, Texas. So on the first day of early voting here in suburban Houston, I went and got in a line and waited for about 2 hours and 45 minutes to cast my ballot. During that time, I saw a sum total of one person who didn't have a face mask on. Everybody else participated in wearing a mask, and I think it's a very positive sign that this is becoming an accepted norm in our society. On a separate but maybe related note, I think it's also a very good sign that thousands of people were willing to wait in line with me for that long amount of time just in order to cast their vote. Hope this makes you smile.
It is excellent that they were willing to wait in line. It's tragic and deplorable that they had to. But yes, for sure. For sure.
Mm-hmm. That, man, the Texas voting, the Texas early voting story is fascinating and maybe like a little bit underreported in terms of how these campaigns are seeing Texas. Like, neither of them seem to think of it as a battleground state, and yet the turnout and engagement is like through the
roof. So I'm at that page that we've talked about a couple of times on the Daily Pod on Fridays about early vote totals. Texas now is at 51.4% of its total 2016 turnout already. It's amazing.
Right. I mean, Travis County, they say, I think we already said this on the show, or I already said it on the show, that is at like 97% of eligible voters registered. I mean, it is happening. And it's just remarkable to see. Like, welcome, America, to your electoral process.
Yeah.
I know. I'm real curious about how that's going to turn out. Turns out, we only had like 2 weeks to find out. Next up, also see how fun the voice memos are. Now Tom in Texas gets to tell his family he's like so famous. Yep. Next up, we have a suggestion in response to the story we talked about last Wednesday about all the money that swag companies are making from virtual conferences.
Hey, Kai and Molly. This is Amanda from Columbus, Ohio. And I think if you make this t-shirt that says, "Please explain to me," on the back, it should say, "Well, here's the deal," because that's how Kai tends to answer such questions. And when we're on the topic of apparel-based swag items, I think you should make a pair of PJ pants with bananas on them, because banana pants is another perennial favorite. Keep this in mind for your next round of fundraising.
Stephanie Patterson in Sheridan, if you're listening, I'm just saying, that's the next round of stuff. Those are good ideas.
Yep.
I like those.
We've discussed it.
Yeah.
And I love it.
We need good marketplace. That's all I'm saying.
Let's see. What else do we have? I know. I want some banana pants. I'm into it.
Okay.
And voice memos.
One more. Friday, we talked about how almost a million women have left the workforce during this pandemic. And in fact, just in the last month, in the month of September, it was like 860,000 or something. Anyway, got a voice memo from Megan in Arkansas. She is the mother of four.
Every time y'all talk about women leaving the workforce and school inequality, I want to stand with praise hands. It's just been a comma tragedy of epic proportions. Multiple overlapping Zooms for each kid due to therapy and regular school schedules. I mean, my mom moved in last month to help, and I still ended up quitting my remote work job as a highly qualified professional statistician. So right now, my husband brings in the paycheck, my mom runs the house, and I teach and manage the kids. So that's three full-time adults and one paycheck. The system is completely broken and is unsustainable, even for those of us that are at the height of privilege and access. Guys, keep talking about all of this, and thank you for making us smarter.
Yeah, so think about the trickle-down effects of that, right? Because Megan now has left the workforce. Who knows when she's going to be able to get back in? And when she does get back in, she will have lost pay and seniority and time in grade and all of those things that you need to move up the ladder professionally to get more responsibility and all of that jazz. And this is insane. It's insane.
Yeah. Yep. It is insane. There was a really good piece the other day, too, that was like, stop acting like people who are privileged shouldn't be complaining about how hard it is to deal with, you know, kids at home and remote work and all of that, because this was never how society was intended to operate. Yeah. Nobody throughout history has ever just sort of been like alone trying to function in a society in which you will like die and be thrown out of your home and lose your health insurance if you don't have a job, but also send your kids to school at risk of being arrested for like truancy. Like it's no, this is not normal. And, you know, have and being middle class does not exempt you from the difficulty of it. In fact, if anything, this story is like, it just makes me so furious every time we talk about
it. Well, and props to you, honestly, for being early on the rage is going to happen when everybody goes back to school thing, because you were on this early. Much as, by the way, you were on the coronavirus as Armageddon early. So, you know, props where props are due.
Thanks, man. I still think there should be a little more rage, but
well, you know, I was going to go there, but then I decided I wouldn't. But now that you have, yeah, I'm kind of amazed there is not more rage, like visible, just palpable. Yeah. This is hurting me in desperate ways, and Washington doesn't care. You know?
Yeah, I thought there would be like a general strike, but maybe where the rage is standing in line to vote.
Maybe, yeah, maybe.
Maybe that's. Yeah. The direction in which the rage is flowing. I guess we'll, like I said, find out soon. Yeah. Tomorrow is What Do You Want to Know Wednesday, buddy. Where we're going to answer your questions. There is still some time to make Ethan dig through a couple more via email. The address is makemesmart@marketplace.org. Subject line, questions. We will answer written and voice memo questions, in fact.
We will take all questions.
Tell your friends. Oh, you're totally famous. Oh, see you next time.
Make Me Smart, this podcast that you're listening to every single day, right, is produced and directed by Marissa Cabrera. Tony Wagner is our digital producer. Erica Phillips writes our newsletters, also our smart speaker skills. Beloved intern Ethan Parrots does everything else.
I hope that goes on his resume. Today's program was engineered by the razor sharp Drew Jostad and mixed by Daniel Ramirez. Our theme music was composed by Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez. The senior producer is Donna Tam, and the executive director of On Demand is Sitar Nieves, both of whom are just bravely hanging on despite whatever craziness we bring to the show.
I know.
No one, here's a headline from my new favorite homepage. No one is shocked. Three skulls were found in Cannibal Corpse guitarist's home. I love Microsoft Edge land. It's a parallel universe.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Soul to Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Soul to Story are available now.